Namo myo renge kyo, namo myo ho renge kyo, namo myo ho renge kyo. Hi everyone, thanks for being here. Thanks for your practice. I hope this finds you in good health and secure. As always, deeply appreciative of your practice. We're in the middle of this already. And we're going to continue with Shakyamuni speaking in verse. And as I've said before, the verse sections are the sermon. The sermon in that this is the essential teaching. Everybody learns this and spreads it orally because it's a pentameter, right? So it's easier to memorize. It's easier to recall and repeat. And the other stuff is part of the sermon as well, but it's, I suspect, more directed generally to the audience he's speaking to, which means that the concepts are there, they're all the same, but a different audience might hear it a little different. He might actually orate it a little differently, although because he's taught these sermons for years, I'm sure he developed quite a pattern of repetition in those sections as well. But one thing we can know for sure, the pentameter sections, the verse sections, are the critical teaching of the sermon, yeah? So we were in the middle of it. We're going to continue today. If anyone preserves it, we're talking about the Myoho Renge Kyo, the Lotus Sutra, yeah? Even for a single moment, I shall truly rejoice. Buddhaness, right? Shall truly rejoice. All of the Buddhas will do so also. In other words, if you, even for a moment, while you're studying, practicing Myoho Renge Kyo, you invest your life, sense of life, into it. This is the essence of life. Then Buddhaness will be satiated, will be satisfied, will be in your mind. Such people as these are praised by the Buddhas. They are courageous. They are persevering. They are known as those who follow the rules of good conduct and carry out ascetic practices. Self-control, basically. Self-control. It's interesting when you think of the language we've developed around our beingness in samsara. The clues are all there. if we stop and really consider what we're saying, it's odd in a way that we have to be awakened to that, how language plays with this aspect of our reality, our inherent Buddhaness. Subsequently, they quickly attain the highest Buddha path. Those in the future who recite and preserve this sutra are the true heirs of the Buddha and abide in the stage of purity. That's you and I, my friends. Those who can understand its meaning, always the critical point, after the Buddha's extinction, nirvana, will become the eyes of the world. Follow that, right? The eyes, the Guanzhan eye, the Buddha eye. We become the awakened ones, not the closed eyes, the open eyes, right, of Buddhahood. For devas and humans, those who teach it, even for a moment, in the fearful world, and we live in the fearful world, will be revered by all the devas and humans. And that's the end. Wow, I thought there was more to it. But that's the essence of the teaching, right? This is the end of the jeweled stupa. And so as soon as he provides for us, Shakyamuni, the visual story of discovering our Buddhaness, in the ceremony or the assembly in the sky, yeah, through the seven-jeweled, Namo Myoho Renge Kyo, seven-jeweled stupa or treasure tower, which is our innate Buddhahood. This is why it happens in the sky, not on a mountainside, not on the earth. It's not samsaric, it's mental. That's why it's in the sky, floating. This is where we find, where we discover in our mind the seven-jeweled, the Namo Myoho-Renge-Kyo, the how many ways can we say it? The portal, the Gohonzon, Buddha eye. Right? It's like opening, taking a piece of plywood off of a sheltered window and suddenly seeing the truth, the inseparability of self and environment, that the individuation, the discriminations, all apparatus for identification, really identify the ego, the true self, is one with everything. The universe, the cosmos is self. So this is the wrap-up. And then when he says all Buddhas recognize, that's Buddha-ness is fully implemented, fully awakened. All right. Well, that only took 6 minutes. Wow. I guess I'll go ahead and transition into the next chapter. It's interesting that the chapter that's inserted after that one is Devadatta, because now he's going to tackle one of the most difficult conversions, if you will, transmigrations in his orbit. Devadatta at one time did many things to try to exterminate, defame, or kill Shakyamuni. He wanted to take his place because he was so erudite, knew all of the teachings. It's always fascinating to me when students believe that they know the teaching of their mentor, their teacher, better than their mentor teacher does. But this is the history of man, right? And sometimes they may have clear insights that seem superior to their mentor, just like a son and a father. And then with experience and some humbling experiences, they suddenly grow to respect the wisdom of their father, mentor, teacher, beyond what they thought they knew. This is the story of the arhats, right? Thinking they had achieved what they had not. Well, here's Devadatta, the prime example within the history of stories of Shakyamuni's teachings. And this is the chapter where it comes to a head. Kind of makes sense to put that after this previous chapter and all the chapters leading up to it, to show ad nauseum, really, this enlightenment, this seven-jeweled tower, this treasure tower, it is your mind. Don't associate it with me, Shakyamuni. Don't associate it with some deity or some presence or something outside of yourself, as Nichiren would say. The Gohonzon, the access to the Buddha eye, the enlightenment, the awakening, is nowhere outside of your flesh and blood body. Those are Nichiren's words, right? That's where Gohonzon is. Not on that scroll. That scroll is extremely useful. It's a wonderful implement, a tool that Nichiren created for universally representing the Treasure Tower chapter. It's an amazing physical representation of this very visual in the air discovery in our own apparatus, our sentient mind. All right. So we start chapter 12. Devadatta. The Buddha then addressed the assembly of bodhisattvas and also the devas, humans, and fourfold assembly, saying, "In the past, immeasurable kalpas ago, I tirelessly sought the Lotus Sutra, the Myoho Rengekyo, the ultimate method for self-enlightenment." So he was a bodhisattva. "Throughout many kalpas, I always became a king and made a vow to seek highest enlightenment. My mind became irreversible." Right? This is a stage of bodhisattva, right? Irreversible. "Wanting to fulfill the six perfections, I diligently carried out practices, unstingingly giving elephants, horses, and seven precious treasures," always seven, "countries and cities, wives and children, male and female servants, my head, eyes, marrow, and brains, the flesh of my body, hands and feet, without stinginess, not even hesitating to give my own life." All of that, that whole sentence, that's about the earlier teachings. And all the stories of, like, the medicine king burning his arms, or the, I don't remember the names, but people cutting patches of skin off just to write down one single sentence, verse, word of the teachings of the Dharma. All sorts of stories about, take my life if I can just hear, have a chance for enlightenment, for a moment, just, I don't need this thing, this physical samsaric thing. I need my mind to be clear, to understand once and for all the engine of life. All countless stories, right? Always confronting the body. This is the story of man ad nauseum. The only thing of value in samsara that we understand is our physical body. This apparatus, which we individuate as a separate thing from its environment. You could say that's a priori problem in the samsaric mind. Because from that comes this, I need to identify this body as unique and special. And why is it unique and special? Well, it has all these things. It has these colors. It has these smells. It has it, right? Everything is identification. But when you get down to it, that's not you. That's a straw man, an ego, a representation of what? The real you is something completely united in the cosmos itself, running with the engine, the momentum, the experience of living, not what has been. So yeah, all these offerings, not only things like kingdoms and servants and all that, but finally, even his own life. I don't need this. I need this. I need my experience, my knowing. Okay. At that time, the lifespan of the people in the world was immeasurable. Interminable, really. It just seemed that way, right? That time thing we keep running into in Buddhism. A lot of suffering makes life feel endless, right? So at that time, the lifespan of the people in the world was immeasurable. Is that a bad thing? No. It's just a visualization of the arduous nature of life. Life is suffering. First Noble Truth. In order to seek the Dharma, I abandoned my kingdom, abdicated my throne to the crown prince. Beating a drum, I proclaimed to the four directions that I was seeking the Dharma, the experience of life, not just the collection of thingness. Saying, I will be as a servant for the rest of my life to whoever, whosoever can teach me the Mahayana. At that time, there was a sage who came to this king and said, I possess the Mahayana teaching called the Lotus Sutra, the Myoho-ryen Geikyo. If you faithfully obey me, I will expound it to you. Again, we're in a fable here, right? We're seeing that Shakyamuni is starting to unglue himself. Well, he's done it before, honestly. But in this story, he's saying, once again, Buddha is not me. Buddha is a condition that I inherited from great effort. Having heard the sage, the king became joyful. Now he's talking about himself in the third person. Having heard the sage, the king became joyful and ecstatic, and accompanying the sage, he did everything he was asked. He gathered fruits, drew water, collected firewood, provided meals. He even provided his own body as a bed for the sage. Yet he never tired in either body or mind, and in this way served the sage for 1,000 years. A long time. For the sake of the Dharma, he served him diligently, making certain the sage never lacked for anything. At that time, the Bhagavat, wanting to elaborate on the meaning of this, further spoke in verses. I remember that in the past, many kalpas ago, although I became king of the world, in order to seek the great Dharma, I was never attached to the desires of the five senses. Right? How many times have we heard this? Striking a bell, I declare... Oh, the drum became a bell now. Striking a bell... I wonder if that's why we use a bell. I declared this to the four directions. If anyone possesses the great Dharma and explains it to me, I will become his servant. At that time, there was a sage called Asita, who came to be great king, and to the great king himself, and said, I possess a subtle and true Dharma that is rare in the world. If you are able to practice it, I will explain it to you. Now see how subtly different that is than what we read in the story. He's already identified this subtle and true Dharma as the Lotus Sutra. I think that's interesting. On hearing what the sage said, the king became overjoyed. He immediately accompanied the sage and performed whatever he asked. He gathered firewood and various fruits. He respectfully offered them whenever requested because he longed for the true Dharma. He never tired in body or mind. For the sake of sentient beings, he diligently sought everywhere the great Dharma. So already he's expounding that it wasn't just for himself. Something I remind you guys of all the time, that when we endeavor to awaken ourselves, there is always this subtext that by enlightening ourselves, we will benefit the world. We will benefit everything in our environment, others. It's endemic, it's intertwined with our enlightenment that we affect the lives of those around us. Why? Because we're all energy, just like a magnet. A magnet has certain energies, a field of energy, yes? Electromagnetism, it's energy. And what's around that electromagnetism is affected by it. By chanting, we make our magnet more powerful. So if it's going to be more powerful, it should be powerful in a productive manner, in a life-affirming manner, yeah? He never sought it for his own sake, nor for the desires of the five senses. For this reason, although a great king, he diligently sought and attained this Dharma, ultimately becoming a Buddha. That is why I now tell you this. The Buddha addressed the monks, saying, the king at that time was I myself, and the sage was he who is now Devadatta. What? Devadatta? taught Shakyamuni how to awaken? What? Well, again, don't forget, Buddhism is about the mind, attitude, and intent, and constantly using the device of time before and after, right? In the device of time, we all are playing before and afters with each other because that's how we learn. Someone does or says something, it causes us to reflect and try to understand. And it, because we're moment to moment, moment to moment, momentum, where do our understandings, our interpretation of life come from? It's the interaction that keeps our momentum productive, analytical. We take that function of our samsaric data collection and identification and we flip it through our enlightenment to become more profound understanding of the engine of life. Nothing gets wasted. Nothing gets terminated. It's the actual paradigm shift of our sentient mind. And Buddhism uses this device constantly. Through the virtuous friendship of Devadatta, I was able to become endowed with the six perfections. Now, you could say in another way, translate that as, he confronted me so many times that I had to come to terms with aspects of myself, as well as others, like Devadatta, that I was unfamiliar with, grappling with. And so that honed my understanding, my Buddhism, my Buddhahood, my skillful means. Benevolence, compassion, sympathetic joy, generosity, the 32 marks, the 80 excellent characteristics, reddish gold skin, the 10 powers, the 4 kinds of fearlessness, the 4 methods of gaining trust, the 18 excellent qualities, the transcendent powers, and the power of the path. All of these advancements, these accomplishments, he offers Devadatta up as his teacher, as you are mine, as I hopefully am yours. We are all this interaction teachers and students, right? This is the core of Bodhisattva, isn't it? You could say the core of Bodhisattva is the Buddha way. Yeah, but the Buddha way requires this interaction in order to elevate, teach, facilitate Buddha-ness for others as well as ourselves. It's a reciprocal relationship. This is why attaining Buddhahood in isolation is woefully incomplete and imperfect. Only through Bodhisattva, this attitude, this intent, do we expand greatly and understand the merits, the wonder, the accomplishment, the attainment of Buddhahood. As you said earlier, even if you just teach one person, or teach, that word is problematic, we guide someone else towards something that we don't even know perfectly or completely. But in the act of helping, we learn, and they as well, and so on and so on. The Buddha addressed the fourfold assembly saying this: after immeasurable kalpas have passed, Devadatta will then become a Buddha called Devaraja, a Tathagata, completely enlightened, perfect in knowledge and conduct, well departed, knower of the world, unsurpassed, tamer of humans, teacher of the Devas and humans, Buddha Bhagavat. Now, he's already done this with the Sharvakas and the Pratyekabuddhas, and even the Arhats, right? Came to realize, oh, crap. we didn't really get there. This bodhisattva practice will get us to much greater heights of realization and knowledge. And now he's picking on his foremost scholar that's been following, tried to kill him, but... and demonstrating, because everybody knows Devadatta. They know his history, but they know he's also a follower, and not a follower in the sense of a bad thing, but a student of, a dedicated student of Shakyamuni. And so now a person, says Devadatta now stands for every person who's had such serious doubts about Buddhism and Shakyamuni's teachings that they've actually gone against him. Maybe not to the degree Devadatta is, but has been. But we're, again, Buddhism about the mind. When your attitude goes sour, that doesn't mean you can't attain enlightenment. So Devadatta stands in for that whole aspect of our minds, yeah? His world will be called Devasopana. At that time, the Buddha Devaraja will abide in the world for 20 intermediate kalpas and extensively teach the true Dharma to sentient beings. Sentient beings equal in number to the sands of the Ganges River will attain enlightenment, says Arhatship, but that's, again, BDK. That's already been shown to not mean what they're using it to mean here in the previous chapters. So why do they continue to use it? See the biases? Yeah, just understand the intent of the statements and the writings, not so much the translations. If you really look at it, it falls apart anyway. The thought of a Pratyeka Buddha has awakened in incalculable numbers of sentient beings. He thought of the highest path will awaken in sentient beings equal in number to the sands of the Ganges River, and they will become convinced of the non-arising of all dharmas and reside in the stage of non-retrogression. The non-arising of all dharmas, what does that mean? That's again a reference to craving and clinging. See, we think of things happening from previous causes and effect, don't we? I hear people teach that all the time. This is because you did this. And this is how we experience samsara in a timeline. This begot this, begot this, begot this. But in Buddhism, we don't think that way. Well, or we try not to. In our enlightenment, it becomes more obvious, maybe I'll say it that way, that we have a karmic amalgam of being. And that amalgam is constantly moving through time. And as it moves through time, picture it as that snowball analogy I used, right? It collects more snow. That's the 3,000 realms in each thought moment. There are influences on the snowball that is our life, our material life, although that material is made of energy. So make the snowball a big ball of energy with infinitely tiny, more than the Ganges River, infinitely tiny amalgams of tendencies and conditions of energy. And they're constantly manifesting moment to moment to moment. And some of them are impacted by influences happening in each of those moments as we experience samsara. Now you could say, well, Sylvain, now you're making the proof that things change with previous actions, cause and effect. No, I'm not. Be careful. What I'm saying is that energy, as it is influenced, modifies its beingness. That experience, dharmas, happen moment to moment. And that we, by chanting, make modifications, make influences to those influences so that we can change the next moment of instantiation of that whole amalgam from the previous moment to a slightly different instantiation of that moment. So the cause, if you want to use the terms cause-effect, because they're immediate, right? Moment to moment. Look up moment in this book. Look up, or if you don't have the book, go on the internet and look for Max Planck's units of measure and look up the one for time, the smallest unit of measure, the fundamental unit of measure, and your mind will just blow. It'll melt trying to consider how brief a moment is. Hundreds of thousands of them, trillions of them, have happened in the last sentence I spoke on this video. That's how much influence is blanketing this snowball, this amalgam of you. So every single thought, moment of thought that we experience is re-instantiating in every moment. The only influence is just a tiny, tiny little energetic action. This is karma. Karma is ongoing. Karma doesn't just change direction because something was said or done. It can be more or less affected, and that they don't call it cause and affect. They call it cause and effect because it's the same thing. It happens in that moment. It's like, this is a very bad example, but when you have a glass of water and you put anything in it, Kool-Aid, sugar, salt, and that dissolves, well, obviously that takes time. That's a samsaric example, very, very faulty for what I'm saying here. We need a nuclear accelerator, like a particle accelerator like CERN, to even approach what I'm talking about here. But just as a simple example, getting that back out of that glass of water, it's futile. The moment you put a spoonful of Kool-Aid in the tall glass of water, it's not water, it's Kool-Aid. But the water doesn't know that. Right? Your drinking that water doesn't change. Your experience changes. And that experience, that dharma, it didn't come about. It's happening now. Experience is something you feel moment to moment. You feel, you experience moment to moment when you experience it. You can't say that I've been working for the last 3 weeks for this moment when I drink this Kool-Aid. Whatever. Anticipation is something you feel moment to moment also. It's hard. I know it's hard to wrap your head around, but cause-effect is an immediate one thing for this reason. Now, you'll read about latent cause and latent effect, but this is all the minute distinctions of the way the mind conceives of things and when realizations pop into mind. It's insight. So that insight, how does it come about? There's a reinvestigation of another word we love, epistemology. But that takes lots of time, lots of moments. But the realization, when it comes, it just comes. It's a realization that is now in control of everything we know. In the past, it is irrelevant. That moment is the cause and effect then. So all dharmas are like this. All experiences are like this. We like to couch them, and that's our samsaric way, right? How many times do we get fed up with people who make excuses, desperately trying to set up the little theater so that they can absolve themselves of this or that? It's all baloney. We know it's baloney. Why do we know it's baloney? Because you right now hit my hand with a hammer. I don't care that you had the flu 2 weeks ago. I don't care that you, that doesn't matter. I'm sympathetic to all those things that happened to you. But if you think my thumb feels better because of all of that, you're out of your mind. It sounds discompassionate, doesn't it? But it's, the reality is that what something happens, it just happens, and you experience it happening. There were no requirements for it. Whether it's more probable or less probable, you can argue that till the cows come home. It doesn't matter. What matters is the event, because we live moment to moment to moment to moment. But somehow we abstract that stuff in samsara, and we make a big old mess of it. But the truth, just like enlightenment, is it's either on or it's off. Staying in it, that's our objective in Buddhism, to shift our mind from samsara to turn the light on. Wow. You can turn the light off too. That doesn't mean you've ended it. It just means you're not in it. Moment to moment to moment. The Dharma is an experience. It's not achieved as a result of I memorize this real well. See, that's the whole thing about glued to words comes to mind. The Lankavatara Sutra talks about this in its own way, obviously. So that's why he says, reside in the stage of non-retrogression. Now, when you enlighten, you want to stay there. You don't want to slip back into samsara. That's retrogression. You understand? Then, after the parinibbana of the Buddha Devaraja, the true Dharma will abide in the world for 20 intermediate kalpas, the seven-jeweled stupa, 60 yohanas in height and 40 yohanas in both length and width will be built for for all his relics, and all the devas and humans will honor and revere this beautiful seven-jeweled stupa with various flowers, scented powders, burning incense, fragrant ornament. You know, what if he was talking about Nichiren? Remember, Nichiren identified with one of the leaders, the four leaders of the bodhisattvas of the earth, you and I. Consider that. This story applies to Nichiren. This seven-jeweled stupa will be built for all his relics, and all the devas and humans will all honor and revere this beautiful seven-jeweled stupa with various flowers, cindered powders, burning incense. What are we doing here? Isn't that what we're doing? We're honoring Nichiren's insight. His teaching of the Dharma for however long, incalculable sentient beings will attain enlightenment, awakening. Innumerable sentient beings will be enlightened as Pratyekabuddhas. And the thought of enlightenment will awaken in inconceivable numbers of sentient beings, and they will reach the stage of non-retrogression. Isn't that your and I's mission? My mission. Right? The Buddha addressed the monk, saying, if in the future there are sons and daughters of virtuous families who, upon hearing the Devadatta chapter of the Lotus Sutra, accept it with pure minds and without doubt, they shall not fall into the realms of hell or to the stages of hungry ghosts or animals, but will be born next moment. Birth, death, right? In the presence of the Buddhas in the 10 directions, they will awaken enlightened wherever they may be. They will always hear this sutra, Namu Myoho Renge Kyo. If they are born among humans or devas, they will enjoy a supreme and delightful contentment. And if in the presence of a Buddha, they will be born spontaneously in a lotus flower. So there's the renge, the moment of inspiration, the moment of insight. Namo myoho renge kyo, yeah? At that time, in the lower region, there was a bodhisattva called Prajnaputta, who was accompanying the Bhagavad Pratubhataratna. He urged the Buddha Pratubhataratna to return to the original land. The Buddha Shakyamuni addressed Prajnaputta, saying, "O son of a virtuous family, wait for a moment. There is a bodhisattva called Manjushri. Let us meet him together and discuss the true Dharma. After that, you can return to your original land." At that time, Manjushri, sitting on a 1,000-petaled lotus flower as large as a carriage wheel, together with the attendant bodhisattvas who seated on jeweled lotus flowers, emerged spontaneously out of the ocean from the palace of the Naga king, Sagara, and floated in midair. There we are in the mind again. Floating in midair. Arriving at Mount Gararatkuta, they descended from the lotus flowers and went into the presence of the Buddhas, where they bowed until their foreheads touched the feet of both Bhagavats. Right, we're talking about Taho Buddha and Shakyamuni Buddha. Having honored them, Manjushri approached Prajnaputta, and they greeted each other and withdrew to sit to one side. Then Bodhisattva Prajnaputta asked Manjushri, saying, "Your Eminence, how many sentient beings do you lead and inspire at the palace of the Naga king?" Manjushri answered, "The number is immeasurable and incalculable. It is not possible to express it in words, nor is it possible to calculate it with one's mind. Wait a moment, and you will have proof." Before he had finished speaking, innumerable bodhisattvas emerged from the ocean, seated on jeweled lotus flowers, arriving at Mount Gararatkuta. Wow, these words. They floated in midair. All of these were bodhisattvas who had been led and inspired by Manjushri. Those who had perfected the bodhisattva practices discussed the six perfections together. Those who were originally Shravakas explained the Shravaka practices in the air, and now that they all practice to understand the meaning of the emptiness of the Mahayana, the experience of a moment, disconnected from time. Manjushri said to Prajnaputta, "Thus did I lead and inspire people in the ocean." Thereupon Bodhisattva Prajnaputta spoke these verses in praise. "O one of the great, one of great wisdom, virtue, and courage, this assembly I have now all witnessed that you have led and inspired incalculable numbers of sentient beings. You have expounded the essential character of dharmas and revealed the teaching of the single vehicle. You have extensively led many sentient beings, causing them to quickly attain enlightenment." Yeah, moment. There's nothing quicker. Manjushri said, "In the ocean, I always expounded only the Myoho Renge Kyo." Then Prajnaputta questioned Manjushri, saying, "This sutra is profound and subtle. It is a jewel among sutras and rare in the world. If sentient beings diligently strive to practice this sutra, will they immediately become Buddhas or not?" Manjushri answered, "Yes, they will." But what does immediately become a Buddha mean? Consider that. It means in this moment. The next moment, you have to do it again. You have to stay in Myoho Renge Kyo. Nichiren said this about his own practice, that he now feels as though he spends every moment of his day in Myoho Renge Kyo. That's quite something. That means that every single moment of thought is an experience of enlightened insight. The invocation of that very insight, Namu Myoho Renge Kyo. So yes, they will. No doubt there. There is a daughter of the Naga king, Sagara, who is only 8 years old. She is wise, her faculties are sharp, and she also well knows all the faculties and deeds of sentient beings. What do you suppose this is we're talking about? She has attained the power of recollection. She preserves all the profound secrets, treasures, taught by the Buddhas, enters deep meditation, and is well capable of discerning all dharmas. It's quite an 8-year-old, yeah? She instantly produced the thought of enlightenment and attained the stage of non-regression. She has unhindered eloquence and thinks of sentient beings with as much compassion as if they were her own children. Remember, we talked about this, right? Her virtues are perfect. Her thoughts and explanations are subtle and extensive, merciful and compassionate. She has a harmonious mind and has attained enlightenment. 8-year-old. The Bodhisattva Prajnakutta said, I see that Tathagata Shakyamuni, who has been incessantly carrying out difficult and severe practices for miserable kalpas, accumulating merit and virtue while seeking the Bodhisattva path. Looking into the great manifold cosmos, there is not a single place, even the size of a mustard seed, where this Bodhisattva has not abandoned his life for the sake of sentient beings. Right, so he's saying this was arduous for Shakyamuni. How can this 8-year-old just instantly, how can anyone instantly attain Buddhahood, as Manjushri said earlier? He attained the path to enlightenment only after this. It is hard to believe that this girl will instantly attain complete enlightenment. Right? Isn't that a question you might ask? Most of us would. Before he had finished speaking, the daughter of the Naga king suddenly appeared in their presence. Bowing until her forehead touched their feet, she withdrew to one side and spoke these verses in praise. The Buddha is deeply versed in the characteristics of good and evil, life-affirming, life-unaffirming. And he completely illuminates the 10 directions, he being Buddha-ness, yeah. His subtle and pure Dharma body is endowed with the 32 marks and with the 80 good characteristics, his Dharma body adorned. He is adored by devas and humans and honored by Nagas. There is no sentient being who does not pay him homage. Moreover, that I will attain enlightenment upon hearing him can only be known by a Buddha. I will reveal the teaching of the Mahayana and save suffering sentient beings. At that time, guess who else is speaking up now? Shariputra spoke to the daughter of the Naga king, saying, you say that you will soon attain the highest path. This is difficult to believe. Why is this? Well, the female body is polluted. Ah, the old misogyny's back. It is not a fit vessel for the Dharma. How can you attain highest enlightenment? Now, you ladies, pay attention. This is a rattling moment in Buddhism, in India. Yeah? A female, in fact, well, I'll talk about it later. In fact, I've gone on and I've gone over the time I want to make these videos. So, a teaser. In the next video, we'll get into this misogyny and how Shakyamuni Buddha, with big brass ones, challenges centuries, longer than centuries, millennia, of the minimization of women in most of the world's cultures, right? There are some that were matriarchal, indigenous peoples who respected the wisdom of women, if only for what seemed magical is their ability to make humans. It's pretty magical in a way, right? Very hard to fathom. But anyway, this chapter is full of very challenging ideas to the people of his day. But they should be a clear indication to us of the depth, the truth, of the truth, of the fact of how everything works, right? The engine of life. Thank you for listening. I get enthused sometimes. I don't watch the clock enough, but I like to complete a thought too. Anyway, thank you for listening. Thank you for being a practitioner of the Lotus Sutra. Oh man, I'm having a lot of medications. Seem to live my life with wah. I'm really, really gratified to provide this resource for all of us. All of it, not just these videos. The podcasts, all free. The threefoldlotus.com website with tons of free information and links to YouTube, the mandala store, the bookstore, the ebooks. It's all resources to help bolster our practice, resolve doubts, and most of all, create confidence so that you can keep your practice strong, free of doubt, and savor it. Savor it more and more as you understand how profound it is. And I will see you in the next one. All right? Bye for now.